Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Wright. I'm arguing today on behalf of the Connecticut Office of the Attorney General. With me today is Michael Wertheimer, also of the office, and I'll also be arguing on behalf of Maine Public Utilities Commission and the Massachusetts Office of the Attorney General. The Federal Power Act requires that all rates be just and reasonable, and there are two kinds of rates utilities can charge their customers. They can have tariff rates or they can have contract rates. Tariff rates are rates of general applicability. Well, they do not.
Should you start with the motion to dismiss?
The motion to dismiss was filed by the NRG parties.
Well, you have to respond to it, don't you?
I'd be happy to address that in order.
Are you going to get an opportunity subsequent?
Yes. After Mr. Estes delivers his discussion, I didn't know what extent that was going to take, but I certainly intend to respond to anything raised.
All right.
As I said, tariff rates are of general applicability. They do not require the customer's consent. And in this case, you would have a seller, A, setting rates that would be applicable to all participants in the New England market, and that would be X, Y, and Z. Under a contract rate, those rates are established for particular customers who agree to them. In this case, it would be A and B agree to a contract rate as among themselves. Mobile Sierra Doctrine has a bright line distinction between tariff and contract rates. Essentially, Mobile Sierra applies to contract rates only. In that regard, it applies only to those parties who have agreed to a rate, and it does not apply to tariff rates. Supreme Court, up on this matter, issued granted certiorari on a very narrow question. The question was, does Mobile Sierra's public interest standard apply when a contract rate is challenged by an entity that was not a party to the contract? And the Supreme Court issued an equally narrow resolution of that, and that is that the presumption is not limited to challenges to contract rates brought by contracting parties. It applies to challenges by third parties as well. Now, what that means, if A and B execute a contract, then X, Y, and as between themselves, X, Y, and Z may not contest the justness or reasonableness of that contract as between A and B, except under the Mobile Sierra public interest presumption. Court made no ruling and remanded for your consideration the question of whether the rates at issue in this proceeding were contract rates or tariff rates, and assuming that they were tariff rates, it further directed you to consider whether or not the FERC could treat those tariff rates analogously to contract rates.
Can I ask you a pause for a second?
Yes.
So you are, if you use the nomenclature you're using before, A and B have a contract, you're C. Your argument is that A and B agreed on a contract, on a rate that would apply to you, correct? Is that your argument?
There are two ways that rate could apply to me. Now, first, I want to say this is not involving the rates at issue in this case, so this is somewhat speculative. But that rate...
I'm asking you only about the rates in this case. Is your complaint that A and B entered into a contract or a settlement that applied only... that set a rate that applies to you? Is that that's what you're complaining about?
That we would have to take service directly under the same terms and conditions of the tariff.
Right. That's what you're complaining about, right?
That's part of it, yes.
Why do you think that the Supreme Court didn't rule on that question? Why do you think that instead they ruled on a question that has no application to this case, a contract between A and B fixing only the rates between A and B?
There's two reasons for that. One is they granted certiorari on a question which was very narrowly framed.
Well, I heard the way you framed it. I don't hear anything about A, B, and C in that framing. They just talked about contract. You can have a contract that affects in either way, as you're about to say. What makes you think that they gave a completely advisory opinion about something that has nothing to do with this case?
In part, that would be from the oral argument, the transcript of the hearing, where they acknowledge that it might well be a...
Were you sitting in the audience before when we had this problem about, it's all well, very nice to have discussions in oral argument, but in the end, we can only interpret an opinion.
Yes, and that is fair. What I will tell you...
Is there anything in the opinion that suggests that the court decided that they were just going to give an advisory opinion about something that has no application here, and they weren't going to address the issues that really relate to the petitioner's claims.
No, they wouldn't have addressed it as an advisory opinion. What they did is they narrowed the frame of the question so that it was resolved between two parties that had consented to the contract. Yeah. Parties that had not consented to the contract could be influenced by that contract in two different ways. One way is if they were a downstream user, and if that downstream user under the Supreme Court's model would not be permitted to challenge that contract except under the Mobile Sierra Just and Reasonable Interest, because the contract was as between A and B, not as to that party. That party is not paying the rates. They're subsequently affected by the rates.
Was that your situation, or is your...
No.
No. So why would they have addressed a situation that didn't involve the people who were arguing the case before the Supreme Court?
Because the question as it was framed necessarily assumes whether or not the rate is a tariff rate. Now, if it is a tariff rate, then you are having A and B setting a rate that applies not only as between A and B, but it applies between X, Y, and Z and everybody else that's a New England participant, whether they're a future entrant, whether they're an objector to the settlement. It is essentially a tariff rate, which is another way of framing only, and this is important, another way of framing what it means to be a third party. What kind of a third party? The mobile...
Another way. I'm just not really understanding why the Supreme Court would have decided an issue that appears to be irrelevant to this case. That just doesn't seem like them. So, and I don't see anything in the language here. I read the oral argument. I do see your point in the oral argument, but I don't see anything in the language here, and I certainly don't see it in the language of our own opinion either, that purported to address an issue that wasn't before the court.
Well, I think in your own opinion, the reason for that was there was an intervening event of two Supreme Court decisions that radically transformed the landscape. Prior to the two Supreme Court decisions, it really didn't make sense to speak of the different kinds of third parties that might be affected by contracts. Those that were directly taking service under the contract, or those that were third parties to a contract between A and B. Your decision really was superseded by a new language that the Supreme Court started to use in describing these contracts. The important thing, though, I think, is that the touchstone of the Mobile Sierra Doctrine is consent as among the parties. When the Supreme Court issued its decision in NRG, and it reflected that as well in the Morgan Stanley decision, it only interpreted the Mobile Sierra presumption as a presumption that existed in a contract rate reflected by the consent and agreement of the parties, a meeting of the minds.
Are you saying that the word contract wouldn't apply then to a situation where A and B agree on a rate that they are also going to charge to C? Wouldn't that still be a contract, at least between A and B?
It's not an enforceable contract. If A and B agreed that they would only set a price at a certain rate, that may be an agreement, maybe not a valid agreement, but it may be an agreement as between them. But what that doesn't do is that doesn't make a contract or a settlement agreement, it doesn't transform the rate that is the subject of that into a contract rate necessarily protected by Mobile Sierra. In this regard, because this is emanating from a contested settlement, I would like to take just a moment to tell you why we also think that none of the rates that will emanate from the contested settlement can properly be considered contract rates and subject to the Mobile Sierra presumption. As in the first case, as we know from the FERC rules, the Trailblazer decisions, and the U.S. Supreme Court in Mobil Oil, any time the FERC considers a contested settlement, it is not to apply it is not to assume the reasonableness of that settlement. It is to evaluate the settlement only under the just and reasonable, for ordinary just and reasonable standard. We also know that under Morgan Stanley, that if a contract rate is a contract rate and entitled to a public interest presumption, that the first time the FERC evaluates that contract or any subsequent time, the FERC must apply the higher public interest standard according to Mobile Sierra. Therefore, what I want to make clear is that as a necessary conclusion of those two predicates, we can be sure that whatever a settlement rate is, it is not a contract rate, because FERC is never going to evaluate that initial presumption under the public interest standard is always going to evaluate under the justness and ordinary just and reasonable standard. And by the same tone, under Morgan Stanley, it made clear that any FERC subsequent review or approval of that agreement, whatever's embodied in the settlement agreement or maybe a contract between the parties, is not going to endow those rates with a mobile Sierra presumption or make them contract rates. A settlement may be a contract, but it doesn't mean that the rate resulting from the settlement is a contract rate.
Does it depend on whether or not the settlement that arises reflects market forces in the same way in which a freely negotiated contract does?
I don't believe so. I think...
I asked whether it depends on that.
Okay. Could you rephrase that?
My understanding of the Supreme Court's position is that if, to go back to your A and B, if A and B enter into a contract, that is presumptively just and reasonable because it reflects market forces and therefore can be applied, putting aside to whom? To others.
No, I think it doesn't matter so much that the contract would reflect market forces, but it would be an allocation of risk among the parties, that the parties would whatever settlement or agreement they were making into it.
That sounds more like the original Sierra case than our case. That sounds more like the estoppel notion than the, I thought that I read the Supreme Court as concluding that it was likely it reflected the market and therefore could be thought to be an application of just and reasonable. Isn't that true? Isn't that the way the Supreme Court was reasoning?
I think the Supreme Court was still reasoning under the same grounds of what, under Sierra, of what it means for something to be just and reasonable in the context of a contract. And the contract could mean that the rates could be substantially higher than the prevailing market rate at the time, but it would not, but since it is an allocation of the risk, one that the parties freely take among themselves, that the principal role of the court is not to allow a party to discharge that risk.
So that sounds like you're fighting with the language of the Supreme Court opinion. That's the way we saw it. The Supreme Court seems to have changed the terrain to me. We saw it as more or less that Mobile Sierra was sort of an estoppel notion, that if the parties reach their own agreement, even as in the Sierra case, even if the rates set by that agreement wouldn't pass the just and reasonable test, they would be applied because it was sort of an estoppel notion. But as I read the Supreme Court case, it's rather because, as they reinterpret, it's because that reflects the market forces and therefore is presumptively just and reasonable.
It's presumptively just and reasonable that parties at arm's length negotiation would be able to hash out a contract that would be mutually beneficial to both of them, yes. And it's quite clear that the Supreme Court abandoned any notion of Mobile Sierra being an estoppel doctrine.
Right. So therefore, then the question is, if a settlement is reached in litigation, does that have the same characteristics of a contract reached that presumably reflects the market forces?
Mobile Sierra does not apply to settlement agreements. It does not apply to any mechanisms that are within the settlement. It applies only to a contract rate.
The only question is whether the analogy fits.
No, we don't believe Mobile Sierra applies at any step, certainly in the FERC's evaluation of the contested settlement, and I don't believe a contested settlement because it doesn't involve the interests of all the parties. In this case, many of the parties, several of the parties, did not agree, including one of New England's largest load-serving entities, NSTAR. In this respect, we don't think there's anything in a contested settlement that would form the same presumption of reasonableness, at least as among the parties that objected to it.
So this was, again, another completely advisory opinion, because there was no dispute that this was a settlement, right?
That's correct. But it wasn't an advisory opinion because they did remand to you the critical question of whether the rates at issue here are, in fact, tariff rates, which we think for any number of reasons.
As compared to
a rate that would apply to particular parties who agreed to them.
But was there anybody suggested that this was not just a settlement and that there were non-settling parties who hadn't agreed? That was quite clear, wasn't it? It was quite clear that this is a case about people who did not consent.
That's quite correct.
That's the only people who were petitioning.
The petitioners were the NRG parties in that matter.
The only people who were petitioning for review of the FERC order.
Yes, that's true.
So are you saying that the court decided an issue that had nothing to do with the case at all?
It had to do with the case, but only a very small piece of the case. That is only in the abstract question that they
abstract
took the case.
Abstract sounds advisory. You got another word?
Okay, limited, then. It's the limited question of whether if you're looking at a party A and B and there is consent among those parties, then Mobile Sierra applies.
I thought you had told me that's not the situation in this case.
That is not the situation in this case, because we have a contested settlement.
Right, so you're saying that the Supreme Court looked at a limited, abstract issue that has nothing to do with this case. Is that your position? That is your position, isn't it?
It's my position that this case is quite different than the one that the Supreme Court initially granted certiorari on.
How can it be different? It's the same parties.
Yes,
it's not as if it's some other.
For the very first time, on the brief in opposition and the brief for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, did the FERC actually admit what it had, that this case was not involving contract rates; it was involving rates that were tariff issues. And I think that acknowledgement transformed what went prior to that in the Supreme Court, and it certainly changed the briefing strategies of the parties.
I mean, for the first time, they admitted that where? Here?
When you said
for the first time, I didn't hear the end of it.
For the first time at the Supreme Court on petition for a writ, the FERC raised the question that the issue that they had not granted, that they had not approved the Mobile Sierra provision, Section 4C, in this matter because it was a contract, that it was an that they were actually auction rates and that it had done so on its own discretion and not pursuant to the Mobile Sierra Doctrine.
And you're saying that was not the basis of the opinion at FERC?
No, they specifically disavowed that when the industrial energy...
That sounds like the sort of thing a Supreme Court clerk would have said, dismisses improvidently granted, because the case has nothing to do with the way it was argued below.
The Supreme Court clerk listened to that argument from us. We put that in our brief, and the Supreme Court, they issued the decision they did. But we had raised that it was improvidently granted.
Oh, you did?
Yes, in our brief, on the writ.
Okay.
Bottom side. I seem to have run over some of my time.
Well, it's important for the Supreme Court to say we were wrong because we didn't take into account an opinion that they issued 3 months after we had decided our case.
I couldn't have said it better.
Thank you.
I would like to address, I do have limited time. I had wanted to ask you, or at least to outline some of the areas where the auction rates and the settlement transition rates have all the hallmarks of an auction. Those were raised in the brief. This case has had a long history, and I don't need to tire you with lengthy discussions. But I did want to address the issue of whether FERC has the discretion to apply the Mobile Sierra standard outside of the contract context, because this is an area, and obviously we agree with the FERC 100% that these rates are tariff rates, not contract rates, and not subject to any Mobile Sierra presumption. But we disagree very strongly with the FERC on the question of whether they have the discretion to apply those rates.
Well, that goes back to my question, which I don't think you squarely answered. If whatever you call them, whether you call them tariff or contract or something in between, if they arise out of a settlement in litigation that reflects market forces in the same way a contract would reflect market forces, doesn't FERC have a right to say, therefore, it's just and reasonable, or therefore, we'll give you a presumption similar to what we would do under the reconstructed Mobile Sierra Doctrine?
No, they don't. FERC, the Congress has set out the statute for what the FERC is, how they are to review rates. And that is under the ordinary just and reasonable standard. FERC is not permitted to arrogate for itself the determination of reviewing those rates under any separate standard whatsoever.
I thought the point the Supreme Court was making is that this is not a separate standard. This is just a kind of just and reasonable standard, and that since those words are broad and expansive, the court's view was that it would defer to the agency as long as it's just and reasonable and can have different just and reasonable approaches depending on what else has happened in the context of the case. And I think Judge Silverman's point is that the more it looks like a contract, the more it looks like it's negotiated. Footnote 4 of the Supreme Court's opinion sounds like the Supreme Court is saying that under those circumstances, Mobile Sierra may apply. What do you say about footnote 4 of the Supreme Court's opinion?
Footnote 4 only specifically reflects that third parties, that the court's determination that third parties are not bound by contracts, while true, is not entirely dispositive of the situation. And I think what that goes to is a dichotomy between which kind of third parties we are.
That's something you're telling me, but it's not in the footnote. You mean that they mean to incorporate the oral argument into that footnote?
If I am a tariff taking, if I am an entity taking tariff service, then I am by definition a different kind of third party than a third party that is challenging a rate as between A and B. The Supreme Court issued its decision with respect to A and B. The Supreme Court remanded the issue of whether you are a tariff customer or these are tariff rates. And I would submit to you that if it is a tariff rate, then the type of third party you are, a third party is being required to directly take service under terms and conditions that you did not agree to, is fundamentally different. And that's precisely the issue that the Supreme Court has remanded to, because if it is a tariff rate and there is no consent, remember, Mobile Sierra presumption only applies to parties that have agreed to a contract rate. It does not apply to parties that have not agreed to it.
The transition payments, is that issue moot now?
I don't think it's moot because it's capable. Clearly, the transition period is past, but I think it's an important point for the court to understand, because these types of settlements can take place, obviously, in the future. Now, transition payments may...
You want us to make an advisory opinion. If it's moot, in your case, it's moot for us.
When you say it's capable, you're about to say capable of repetition yet evading review, but this kind of agreement, this is not likely to happen, or you can't give us a reason to think that it's going to happen sometime in the near future again.
Oh, I do think so, because this is precisely the same issue that's happened with all of the reliability must run contracts that the FERC has been approving. And while those have technically ceased now with the implementation of the forward capacity market, there's a lot of discussion about whether there might be some replacement mechanism necessary. And in these cases...
Well, we don't know that replacement mechanism is going to look anything like
no,
this.
No, but my only point is that there are many different grounds by which the FERC can approve two parties having an agreed rate, and that therefore...
But it is the case that as to these transition payments, you never filed any objection that they weren't just and reasonable during this period, right? And it's over. Both
Correct.
Of those are true. Let me ask one last question. I understand exactly what happens here. So you are permitted to attack the rates under the auction rates, under the just and reasonable standard for 45 days, right?
That's correct, under the settlement agreement.
Right. So if you attack them and they're held just and reasonable, you want still during the remaining 3 years to be able to attack them again under the same standard?
Absolutely, because that's what Section 206 of the Federal Power Act provides.
Right, I'm just wondering how stable of a system you can have if the rates, you know, if it's announced these will be the rates, construction goes forward on the assumption that those are going to be the rates. You had 45 days in which to challenge them. You did, and they're still held just and reasonable. How can you have a system? Or is your point that the system has to collapse totally?
No, there's no collapse. This is a system of the Federal Power Act that's been established by Congress.
No,
and these
the
rates.
The auction system has to collapse totally.
Well, the auction
unless you agree to it.
I apologize. What I'll say is that rates that are just and reasonable today may not be just and reasonable 2 years from now. We've seen dramatic swings in prices in the capacity prices, both for the transition payments and in the capacity market that's existing.
I understand all that, but that means then that firms that go ahead with an understanding about what the rates will be and therefore construct, et cetera, shouldn't do that. Everybody should understand that the rates can change wildly at any point, and therefore they should only build new plants, et cetera, if they're willing to take a risk within 3 years that the rates will be different than they plan on.
All parties should understand that the operation of the Federal Power Act provides that rates be reviewed for their justness and reasonableness. Now, that's not to say that the FERC can't take into consideration whether or not these parties' legitimate contract expectations go into the question of whether the rates are just and reasonable. That's part of the administrative balancing of interests that FERC does when it evaluates rates. What FERC cannot do is erect a rebuttable presumption that complainants can't even get their foot in the door to challenge the rates for their just and reasonableness, because FERC has determined already. And not only that FERC has determined already, but FERC has bound future commissions, that FERC has determined for all time that
for
anybody...
For the next 3 years.
Well, there may be a future commission until the expiration of the contract rate. Expiration of the tariff rate.
Well, there's a Freudian slip, isn't there? Okay, thank you.
Okay. What I'd like to point out is with respect to FERC's determination that it has the discretion to apply a standard review separate from that from Congress, I'd like to take a moment to reflect on how what an unprecedented arrogation of authority FERC is now attempting. We've just completed two cases before the United States Supreme Court and on the scope and application of the Mobile Sierra Doctrine. There are very circumscribed rules, who it applies to, under what circumstances, what third parties may challenge, under what standard may they challenge. And this has happened just in the last two terms. And we've had extensive argument over this before this court, before the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court. And now FERC drops this bombshell that says, oh, and by the way, we can also apply this at any time we see fit, just because we think it's just and reasonable to do so. And, you know, we'd ask, what was the purpose of these two Supreme Court cases where everybody fought so hard to get the precise standard of when the public interest standard would apply, when it would not, under what circumstances for the contract? And now FERC is essentially telling us.
When you say they dropped the bombshell in the Supreme Court, the Part 3 of the Supreme Court's opinion, which remands, makes it quite clear the court understood that everything hadn't been decided. Isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely.
So this not was raised them for dropping the bombshell today. They dropped the bombshell earlier. It didn't seem to
absolutely,
bother
absolutely, and this is the same issue on remand.
But it didn't bother the court that they dropped the bombshell, so...
They didn't issue a ruling on that. They preserved that for your benefit.
But if it was a complete bombshell, maybe they would have said, this is a bombshell, and our decision resolves what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do.
Okay. Perhaps bombshell is my colorful characterization of
that. Yeah, it's a dangerous word around here
anyway. All right.
Thank you.
We will hear now from FERC.
May it please the Court, Robert Solomon for the Commission. Starting up with some of the questions that were asked Mr. Wright concerning whether the Supreme Court decision is abstract. No, there is nothing abstract or advisory or improvident about the Supreme Court's recent NRG decision. The Supreme Court's NRG decision, of course, incorporated the rationale and the findings and the holding of the Morgan Stanley case. Of course, the Morgan Stanley case followed the decision by this court in the underlying proceeding by 3 months. So the purpose of this case on remand, as explained by the Supreme Court in NRG, is to address those issues that the court had no reason to address because the Morgan Stanley decision, as amplified by the Supreme Court's NRG decision, hadn't issued yet.
As long as we're using letters, if we could go to the hypothetical set of letters that your opposing counsel used, do you think NRG decided the question of when there is a contract between A and B that also sets a rate applicable to C that Mobile Sierra applies?
No, I do not think the NRG Supreme Court decided that question. I think the resolution of that question follows more from the Morgan Stanley decision than from the later NRG decision. The Supreme Court in NRG presumed that there was a valid contract and presumed that the Mobile Sierra presumption that attaches to certain types of Mobile Sierra contracts applied to contracting parties, applied to the commission. The question before the Supreme Court in NRG was whether there was some type of Mobile Sierra third-party contract exception. And all the Supreme Court...
Just so I understand this A, B, and C point, do you think that the Supreme Court, with this presumption, decided that if there was a contract between A and B that set a rate applicable to C, that Mobile Sierra applies? Or do you think the Supreme Court only dealt with situation where A and B set a rate, contracted to set a rate that applies to them, and C challenged it?
The latter, not the former.
So you're in agreement with the petitioners on that point?
On this point. And this is unusual because on remand from the Supreme Court, the commission, the respondent, finds itself in agreement to some extent with the petitioners.
Let me pause for one more second. And on that point, that scenario, however, is not the scenario of this case.
You both agree with that as well. Exactly. And for purposes of determining when the Mobile Sierra presumption attaches, it's important to go back to Morgan Stanley and look at the Morgan Stanley definition of a Mobile Sierra contract, which is when you have arm's length, good faith negotiation between sophisticated parties with equal bargaining strength, which produces a willing buyer and a willing seller when there's no evidence of fraud, duress, or any type of unlawful or manipulative market behavior. Yes, it is the Commission's position in this case, and this is where we do agree with the petitioners, that on the issues remanded by the Supreme Court in NRG, the auction results resulting from the forward capacity auction and the transitional payments, those cannot be the type of arm's length good faith negotiations producing a presumptively just and reasonable rate. A and B can negotiate among themselves as to a Mobile Sierra rate that the commission, as well as any contesting or non-contracting third parties, must accept, must presume as just and reasonable. But when you bring into account actor C or D or E, or when you have tariffs of general applicability as opposed to a bilateral contract, that takes this case outside the fact pattern as identified by the court in Morgan Stanley. There's no bombshell here. The Supreme Court in NRG undertook an analysis of the one issue that was definitively presented. If you have a Mobile Sierra contract, does that presumption attach not just simply to the commission, but also to third parties? The Supreme Court said, how can it be that the commission,
I was just wondering, why was that the issue before the court? Was the government wasn't arguing there was a presumption under that circumstance, was it?
No, by the time of NRG, the government was accepting the presumption as announced by the Supreme Court in Morgan Stanley. The Supreme Court...
The government wasn't, just so I understand, the government was not arguing in NRG that under the circumstances of this case there was a presumption, correct?
Correct.
And the petitioners, that is these people, were not arguing before the Supreme Court that there was a presumption.
Correct.
We didn't hold that there was a presumption.
That is correct.
Why did the Supreme Court decide the question of whether there was a presumption if there's not a single party or a court below?
Because fundamentally, this court's decision, which issued 3 months before the Morgan Stanley decision, made a mistake concerning
the... We didn't hold anything about a presumption, about there being a presumption, did we?
Right. At the time of this court's decision, 3 months before Morgan Stanley, there was no argument, there was no understanding that, in fact, Morgan Stanley carried a presumption that attaches not just simply to third parties, but attaches to the commission, even if the commission has not reviewed the contract in the first instance. And this is why there is some agreement between the commission and third parties, because just as third parties are subject to a presumption when in fact there is a legitimate Mobile Sierra contract, so too the commission is burdened with a very high presumption when in fact there is a Mobile Sierra contract.
Just to boil it down, your position is that if there is a contract between A and B setting the rates between A and B, there's a Mobile Sierra presumption. Yes?
Yes, because that was decided in Morgan Stanley.
And if there is a contract between A and B setting rates applicable to C, there is no presumption.
Yes.
But you have the discretion to apply Mobile Sierra to that.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
And even if there is not a contract, you also have discretion to apply.
Yes. And those...
Any limitation at all on when you can apply it?
Well, of course there's a limitation on the commission.
Of course. What is the limitation?
Well, as this court said below in the first section of the main PUC decision, for purposes of determining what's just and reasonable, the commission cannot pluck rates out of thin air. Any decision the commission makes for purposes of construing and applying the just and reasonable standard has to be based on substantial record evidence. And
what are the circumstances in which you could not approve a Mobile Sierra clause?
The commission would not be able to approve a Mobile Sierra provision if presented with a settlement which, as an overall package, unlike the one here, did not advance the overall consumer interest, did not advance the investor interest.
But there's no sort of structural limitation. It's not limited to things that look like contracts, that involve settlements, that have a just and reasonable first step, none of that?
Exactly, Your Honor. For purposes of contracts...
When you say exactly, I'm not sure.
I'm saying the agency has discretion for purposes of determining what is just and reasonable when we are presented with something other than a classic Mobile Sierra bilateral willing buyer, willing seller contract. In circumstances of this type, when you have tariffs of general applicability that set the rate not just simply for contracting parties A and B, but for C, D, and the rest of the alphabet, if that is not the type of contract that was addressed by the Supreme Court in Morgan Stanley, and the commission argues that that, in fact, is true, that this is not the type of contract that was addressed by the Supreme Court in Morgan Stanley, even though the commission is not compelled to adopt a very high, very stringent Mobile Sierra standard, for purposes of applying the just and reasonable standard based upon the circumstances, based upon the substantial record evidence, the commission may, in the circumstances, allow, as a matter of discretion, this type of standard of review.
That's true even if it's a tariff that's not subject to part of a settlement.
Yes, if it's something that is presented to the commission for the commission's review under the just and reasonable standard. The most important part of the Morgan Stanley decision for purposes of this case was the finding, and reiterated by the Supreme Court in NRG, that there is only one statutory standard, which is the just and reasonable standard.
Let me ask one more question. This whole analysis that you've given us now, is that reflected in the underlying FERC opinion?
Yes, I think it is. As a practical matter, the underlying FERC...
They anticipated Morgan Stanley and NRG?
No party could have anticipated.
Morgan Stanley seems to have changed some things, and you said that you've now accepted that. But you're saying that the opinion below actually managed to guess all these things in advance?
No, the opinions below did not guess everything. It guessed some things, but not other things. What it did not do is find definitively that the auction results and the transition payments were not Mobile Sierra contracts. And of course, the reason why the commission did not do that is because the definition of the Mobile Sierra contract and the interpretation of the cases that carry a presumption, of course, was not announced until 3 months after this.
You're opposing
may I ask for a question? I'm reading paragraph 90 of commission's opinion. We also reject IECG's contention that market rules and tariffs are not contracts to which Mobile Sierra can apply.
Yes.
Well, that sort of suggests that you thought they were contracts.
No,
as
I don't
Napal,
think...
Well, something like that. As Napal points out, tariffs have been held to be analogous to contracts. Additionally, the Commission has on many occasions adapted the application of the public interest standard to settlement agreements and contracts, setting forth rates. Moreover, the Mobile Sierra provision in this case applies to the settlement agreement and the rates resulting from that agreement. As noted above, the market rules implementing the settlement we made, et cetera, I can't for the life of me figure out what it is FERC's position was at that time. Is this a contract rate? Is it not a contract rate? Is it a tariff rate? Is it a tariff rate? Is it something like a contract? Is it a quasi-contract tariff rate? Certainly, now I can't blame you for not anticipating the Supreme Court's decision, since I don't think anybody could have. But I still don't understand how you squarely have decided this question down below.
Well, I previously explained in response to Judge Garland's question what the commission did not decide below, and I'm reiterating we did not decide the specific issues that were remanded by the Supreme Court, but what the commission did decide was that it has discretion. It did decide that the settlement...
You don't explain why you had discretion. You don't explain... It didn't seem... Down below, it seemed to suggest... You had the discretion because it was a contract rate or something very close to a contract rate.
Well, let me go to paragraph
90. Isn't that what paragraph 90 says?
Close, but not quite there. This is page 2373 of the JA. This is paragraph 90 in the commission's rehearing order.
We're all on that page.
Okay. There was one party who argued that tariffs and market rules of general applicability cannot possibly carry a Mobile Sierra standard of review. And what the commission said in that paragraph is no, that's not correct, that when you have these tariffs, when you have these filings of general applicability, such as the settlement of the forward capacity market.
You're talking about the same one I was just talking about, 90?
Yes.
I just read it. Why are you repeating it?
I'm just repeating the emphasis on market rules and tariffs. Those are generally applicable filings. This is further clarified 2 pages earlier in paragraph 80 on 2371. The first sentence, that they're arguing that generally applicable market rules and rates cannot possibly carry the Mobile Sierra public interest standard. And what the commission said is, no, that's not true. We have reviewed and we have allowed these types of Mobile Sierra standards of review in contested settlements of this type for many years. The fact that it's generally applicable in and of itself doesn't mean that we can't, under the circumstances, allow for this very high level of public interest review.
Why? What is the reasoning? That's what I'm missing. Where's FERC's reasoning?
The reason is the need for...
reasoning. Where is FERC? Where is it indicated what FERC's reasoning is? Why this standard does apply, or why you have discretion to apply it, and when you don't apply it and do apply it? It's not clear to me.
Well, with respect to Section 4C, which is the Mobile Sierra section of the contested settlement, that is addressed in the settlement order on page 2051 and in the rehearing order on pages 2373. When you get to the Mobile Sierra section, the Commission has already explained for 100 paragraphs the overall public interest in the settlement as a whole. The Commission said under its regulations, which are 18 CFR 385.602H, that when it is presented with a contested settlement, it needs to make a balanced decision based upon substantial record evidence as to whether the entire package is just and reasonable. The Commission said that it's not making a merits determination on the individual provisions, but having said that, the Commission also said in paragraph 184 of the settlement order 2051 that we find this Mobile Sierra provision reasonable, and the reason why the Commission found this particular provision reasonable is the need for infrastructure, the need for market entry, the need for settled expectations, the need for price stability in New England. This is not simply a hypothetical concern. We're now
you could have price stability at an unjust and unreasonable standard, too.
Right, and price stability.
So what troubles me so much, and I'm trying to figure it out, is if I understood the Supreme Court's decision, they concluded that Mobile Sierra should apply in the conditions in which they described it, whether or not it's directly this case or not, because it reflects market forces, not because of an estoppel theory.
Exactly. But
where does this FERC just conclude that this settlement agreement reflects market forces?
Yes, market forces can produce a presumptively reasonable Mobile Sierra contract. But I don't think the Morgan Stanley decision is limited simply to contracts that arise from market forces. That happened to be the case in the Morgan Stanley case. But
well, now, wait a minute. You don't suggest that the Supreme Court concluded that it would be just and reasonable to apply a freely negotiated contract which did not reflect market forces? I thought that was exactly the point the court made.
Well, that is the point that the court made. But
so
the
that
court
it couldn't apply in a situation where it did not reflect market forces. Suppose, and what troubles me about a settlement agreement is a settlement agreement could rely on various factors unrelated to market forces. Could it not?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the Supreme Court, while presented with market-oriented contracts, did not disavow the 50 earlier years of contracting under conventional, traditional, cost-based notions. And the definition that I read from Morgan Stanley, arm's-length, good-faith negotiations, sophisticated parties who will produce a presumptively just and reasonable contract, it can be based on market forces, but it can be based on other forces, including cost-based notions.
Can I ask, you pointed out to paragraph 185, I guess. 186 of that order says, the court has repeatedly emphasized the importance of contractual stability in a number of cases involving the Mobile Sierra Doctrine. If FERC's view had no relation to the fact that this were contract-like, or as Judge Silverman said, perhaps quasi-contract-like, why did it emphasize the contractual stability, not just stability, but contractual stability?
Well, the focus is on rate stability in paragraph 186. The Commission made it clear.
But the support for the first sentence about rate stability is the next sentence, which says the court has repeatedly emphasized the importance of contractual stability.
Yes, and that's a reference back to Mobile and Sierra for purposes of approving this Mobile Sierra provision.
Right.
Of course, again, we didn't have the advantage of Morgan Stanley. But the one thing that the Commission did emphasize repeatedly in its approval of the forward capacity mechanism is the design is intended precisely to allow for rate stability, to allow would-be market entrants, would-be suppliers to know 3 years in advance what the market clearing price will be. We want to encourage a reliable, robust market with necessary infrastructure. And to do so, the parties believed and the Commission believed in approving the forward capacity market that stability is key in enticing suppliers into the market who otherwise would not have the incentive.
Your opposing counsel suggests that you've changed your position. That is, your position here is not the same as it was the last time you were here, which may be, of course, a reflection of Morgan Stanley or NRG. Do you think your position is exactly the same as it's been all along?
The position, of course, is not exactly the same. But
in what respects is it different?
It is different with respect to the precise nature of the auction results and the transitional payments. But the bottom line...
Different in what sense when you say the precise nature? What do you mean by that?
Well, the Commission never had the opportunity to determine whether these precise rates are, in fact, Mobile Sierra rates of the type identified in Morgan Stanley, which, of course, postdated this Court's decision. But what is important is the Commission noted that it has discretion, both in terms of approving the overall package and in viewing the individual provision. If, in fact, there is a Mobile Sierra contract, the agency does not have that discretion. If, in fact, these auction results and transitional payments are, in fact, Mobile Sierra rates resulting from Mobile Sierra contracts that carry a presumption, frankly, there's no need for Section 4C of the settlement. There's no need for an announcement that rates that are subject to this Mobile Sierra presumption will, in fact, receive this Mobile Sierra presumption.
So how did Morgan Stanley change the understanding?
Morgan Stanley changed the understanding fundamentally based upon its finding that the public interest standard as applied in Mobile Sierra is not a separate and distinct extra statutory standard, but rather is simply a particularly stringent application of the one and only.
And why would that matter to the Commission?
That matters to the Commission because it goes to our discretion argument.
You already thought you had discretion, you're telling me.
Right. And in this respect, this part of the Morgan Stanley decision, we think is key. It lays bare the error of this panel in the earlier decision, which thought that the Commission was compelling a non-contracting party to lose a statutory right.
You're saying your position has not changed in any respect, then?
The fundamental discretion that the agency exercised before remains after Morgan Stanley, the discretion that the agency can now apply, because everything is just and reasonable. There are gradations of just and reasonable. Public interest is just a particularly stringent application of just and reasonable.
Let me read what you said to us before. Finally, the Commission reasonably addressed on rehearing contention that the Mobile Sierra Clause must be rejected because it applies to market rules or tariffs of general applicability, rather than contracts between specific parties. This contention, like others discussed above, simply ignores the global consensual resolution of this difficult, protracted proceeding through a settlement of general but not universal agreement. As the Commission has explained, it has on many occasions accepted the application of the public interest standard to settlement agreements and contracts setting forth rates. Contrary to an assertion that any objection they have to a market rule or rate of general application will be subject to just and reasonable standard. In other words, looks like the FERC was saying that this is something like a contract before, and where they're arguing before us.
Well, regardless of whether, in fact, we have a contract or whether we don't.
I'm just focusing on the point that Judge Garland, is that your position is changing, it is evolving,
yes,
almost like some people will involve the Constitution. Forgive me.
I won't touch that latter point.
And I'm disassociating myself.
But as to the former point, yes, we have two intervening Supreme Court decisions.
No, but I don't blame you for that. It's just, why are you objecting so strongly to a remand when you would have an opportunity to explain what your position is in light of this changing legal landscape? Because isn't that to your advantage?
No, I don't think so.
It's a problem in analytically answering the Supreme Court questions?
Well, we would like further analytical assessment of the Supreme Court questions, which were remanded to this court. The precise language...
We can't decide for FERC what... I mean, we don't... you know, we have a Chenery problem there, don't we?
Well, there was a similar Chenery problem in the Morgan Stanley case.
Oh, that's not quite right. The Morgan Stanley Chenery problem was the mandatory application of Mobile Sierra, correct?
That is correct.
And under those circumstances, the agency had no discretion, correct?
That is correct.
And your position is that the agency has discretion, correct?
That is correct.
So then you realize why the discussion of Chenery in Morgan Stanley is really not applicable here,
yes,
correct?
Yes, I understand. And I was just making a reference to the same Chenery argument in Morgan Stanley. But
even though it's irrelevant.
Or inapplicable, at least.
I will rescind my previous 30 seconds of argument and go back to Judge Silberman's question. The Supreme Court understood that there were residual issues that did not have to be resolved definitively. It understood that for purposes of resolving the case, it had to address the third-party exception issue. It did understand fully well that there were these additional two issues concerning contract rates and agency discretion that had not been fully ventilated before the agency or before this panel. And in remanding back to this court, the Supreme Court said these issues remain open for this court's consideration. My supporting interveners are arguing that these issues are closed, that they do not remain open for this court.
But the court said that their remand, you just told us that they weren't fully ventilated in the agency. And needless to say, we can't make a judgment based on counsel's arguments, however articulate. Under Chenery, we can only make particularly a decision in a discretionary matter based on the agency's decision.
I understand. Let me continue with the Supreme Court decision. It says these issues remain open. See transcript of oral argument 16. Well, Your Honor is giggling.
No, no, so that is that not, only because now you have found the place where they've incorporated the oral argument.
Yes, this is the one place where, in fact, the oral argument has been incorporated into the Supreme Court's decision.
I think that's a very good find.
And thank you, Your Honor. The transcript is very helpfully attached to the petitioner's supplemental brief. And for purposes of
but there's nothing. Is there something in that page of the transcript that says that we can't remand to the agency?
Yes, there is something because those are the opening remarks of the Solicitor General on behalf of the FERC in that particular case. And right off the bat, the Solicitor General told the Supreme Court that the only issue that needs to be definitively resolved is the third-party exception issue. And as to these other percolating issues, that we ask the Supreme Court to allow those issues to be resolved by the Court of Appeals. And based upon...
Well, that's reading an awful lot into Mr. Miller's statement. There's nothing in there that suggests that it can't be resolved by asking the agency to give an explanation for its decision.
It's resolved by the Court of Appeals, and I'm doing what I can to give effect to the remand language of the Supreme Court. The agency has some unfortunate experience for purposes of construing remand mandates, and I know that when we do, we want to give effect to the literal language of the court's remand, and we encourage this court to do the same.
But why, as a matter of policy, FERC's policy, FERC's concern, why isn't a remand advantageous to you? To give you an opportunity to articulate your standards for and your reasoning for when you would apply a quasi-Mobile Sierra situation to a tariff, to a something that looks like a tariff settlement?
Well, I have two answers. One is specific to this particular market in New England, and the other is more general to the agency.
First is time, I'm sure.
The first one is what?
Time. Are you concerned about time?
Yes, it's about time, and the parties are eager to obtain some sense of certainty, some sense of finality. The purpose of the forward capacity market is to allow suppliers to know in advance what the rules of the road are and to encourage and entice.
With respect, what is the second argument?
With respect to the second, the Commission now knows from the Morgan Stanley decision what a Mobile Sierra contract is. What we do not know is what a Mobile Sierra contract is not. We would like to have, for purposes of implementing any future any future Mobile Sierra cases, both a lower bound and an upper bound. We know that the conventional bilateral willing buyer, willing seller, market-based rate, presumptively equal, sophisticated parties type of contract that was at issue in the Morgan Stanley case is in fact a Mobile Sierra contract. We would also like to know on the opposite end of the spectrum that these types of auction results and transitional payments, which are not at all like the type of contract addressed in Morgan Stanley, is not a Mobile Sierra contract, and then the agency can fill in the...
Don't you want to take a shot at articulating that yourself? I don't understand that.
The agency is going to have plenty of opportunities to take its shot for purposes of determining what, in fact, is the type of Mobile Sierra contract identified by the Supreme Court.
No, but what about the not?
Well, this court's decision on the remanded issues would certainly help the agency for purposes of determining what is not.
That's a little strange for the agency to ask us to give. That's almost asking us to give an advisory opinion to you.
It is strange, but it's based upon the intervening two Supreme Court decisions. This is a strange case because of the two cases, and I submit the agency did say below that it has discretion. And if, in fact, these were Mobile Sierra contracts, the agency would not have had this discretion. The agency could not find that they're Mobile Sierra contracts because that would divest the agency of discretion.
If it was so important to get a decision on this issue immediately, did you ask the Supreme Court to also to do that?
Yes, we did.
And they declined?
Yes, based upon the representation of counsel for the federal government at the beginning of oral argument.
All right, let us hear from intervener.
May it please the court. Let me try and add some clarity, starting with the jurisdictional question and moving to the merits, the alphabet hypothetical, and the various questions you've asked. We submit that you have no jurisdiction here. And the discussion about the orders and FERC's brief shows you why. Because if you look at who raised the contract rate argument at paragraph 80 and 90 of the rehearing order, and who FERC was citing in its brief, it's an intervener, IECG, an industrial end user group. As we pointed out in our motion, the petitioners in this case never raised the contract rate argument. The commission never imputed
the contract rate argument. They argued, did they not, that they should not be bound by this settlement. Does it matter how they phrased, how they characterized it?
Yes, very much so.
In terms of jurisdiction, in terms of whether they made the argument, they said, look, we're not legally bound to take this settlement.
It does. If you look at what they said on rehearing, and there are three pages in the main PUC's rehearing, 2102 to 04, that matter, they're complaining, and you see it in their specification of error, this settlement's being applied to non-signatories, and that's taking away our statutory rights. The only difference it makes, whether somebody signed the settlement or not, or didn't sign the settlement, all that only pertains to the so-called third-party exception question. You have a contract between several people, perhaps, and there is a third party, an end user, who complains about it. Do they get, in complaining about the derivative problem they see in paying the rates of a contracting party, to escape the public interest standard? The question, the answer now is no, as we know. If this is not a contract rate we're dealing with here, it's a tariff rate, then putting aside the discretion point for a second, The public interest standard does not apply at all, and everyone is free to challenge the rate under the ordinary just and reasonable standard at whatever point in time they want. And it doesn't matter whether you signed a document or didn't sign a document, because what you signed apparently does not create a contract rate in that vein of argument.
It's true, then. The petitioner's argument was we're entitled to the just and reasonable standard.
Yes.
Does it matter whether they said it's because it's a contract, not a contract, so does it matter?
Yes.
And their fundamental argument was they were entitled to the just and reasonable standard.
Your Honor, if that were sufficient to satisfy the statutory strictures of 313B, all any litigant would ever have to do is say the commission violated Section 205, this is an unjust and unreasonable rate as applied to me, and I protest. But the law and your cases require much more. You have to specify your objection to the commission.
Could they have anticipated the nature of the subsequent Supreme Court opinions at that time in order to make the more nuanced argument that you're now suggesting they should have made?
IECG did it 2 years before Morgan Stanley.
Maybe
yes.
More prescient, but...
Well, they had it right, actually. They took these things in sequence. They said they were wrong in the merits. We don't have a contract rate here because we don't have a contract at all. We have a tariff. And then they said, several pages later, after an intervening argument, if we're wrong on that, if this is a contract rate, we're third parties and we're not bound. And that's what the petitioners here argued on rehearing and in their brief. There's also a waiver problem here. If you look at their first brief, you don't see.
Let me put it this way. The argument the petitioners made is the FERC has applied or approved a public interest standard vis-a-vis us. We're entitled to the just and reasonable standard. Now, that is not the hypothetical you described. That's a much more specific argument.
Why are they entitled to the just and reasonable
standard? Now that gets into the kind of arguments that are presented right. Subordinate. The question is whether this is a separate argument or whether this is an elaboration and a nuance of an argument.
Your Honor, from our perspective, if it's separate enough for the Supreme Court to remand the question rather than resolve it, when the petitioners urged vigorously that they were unitary, one subsumed the other, and tried to get the case dismissed as improvidently granted as a result, if they're separate enough for the Supreme Court to remand instead of resolve, that tells you a lot. In addition, they contradict each other. One argument says, we have a contract, but I'm not a party. The other argument says, we don't have a contract. And if you have a rehearing that only raises the second question and presumes or concedes the contract issue, how could you possibly say that the party preserved a contradictory assumption that it never articulated? That can't be implicit in its opposite.
What was the ground for the motion to dismiss as improvidently granted?
The argument was that we don't have contract rates here to begin with. This isn't a contract. It's a rate of general applicability. It's exactly the same thing that we're talking about now. And so we don't. The question the court addressed, you addressed, really was a frolic.
That's how we felt.
And so you should center yourself and just dismiss the case. The court obviously disagreed. The other reason
So they disagreed and they remanded. You're just suggesting they missed the jurisdictional point. Did you raise the jurisdictional point to the Supreme Court?
Yes, and I think they've left that for you. It's open for your consideration. And I'll talk about the mandate in just a minute because I think that there's a lot to be learned there. But just to
they left it open for us. They certainly didn't mention that there was a jurisdictional question that they wished us to consider.
I'll address it now, then, Your Honor. It has been the law for approximately 200-plus years that a jurisdictional issue lurking in the record, not resolved, is open for consideration by a later court.
I think you're right.
I am. And yes. And Chief Justice Marshall said as much in 1805. And what we have here, in the Pennhurst case that we cited, the Supreme Court said an issue that is passed on sub silentio is open. We don't even have that here because nobody ever addressed whether we have tariff rates or contract rates. So the jurisdictional issue was never reached, was never touched by the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court said that the remand issues are open for your consideration, my contention is they left the full palette of your options available: dismissal, remand, Reversal, vacature, affirmance.
I think you have a good point there, but I'm inclined to think that the petitioner's argument was basically made before us when they asserted that they should not be bound by the settlement agreement. It doesn't matter how they characterized it. The logic of their position applied whether it was contract or not contract.
I think, with all due respect, Judge Silberman, that would render 313B a bit of a kabuki dance, because you'd have petitioners on rehearing giving the highest altitude possible answer to a question, never telling which
this
way...
This animal was so peculiar, nobody knew what it was. And as we just read, FERC's opinion was all over the lot on it.
IECG laid this out very carefully. And the only thing you see petitioners complaining about in their petition for a hearing or their first brief before you is the fact that they didn't sign something and now they're being bound by it, which is all about the third-party exception issue perforce. Because if we don't have a contract rate, nobody's bound, including my clients, by the way, who apparently can come in and challenge an auction rate under the lowest possible standard. There was some discussion. Oh, the other reason you know these two issues are separate, is they have
very... Incidentally, FERC refers to the public interest standard as the strictest standard. It was really puzzling to me because I thought it was, under Sierra, the more forgiving standard. I guess it depends on whether you are the...
wants to be forgiven.
Who's attacking who.
These
public interest standard is the more general standard, or let me say I still think it's the easier standard to reach.
Well, and it's a standard designed to protect third parties. Sorry, Your Honor. But going back to the jurisdictional question, I think if you look at the case through the lens of the contract rate issue never being really urged by a petitioner, and you look at what you decided and what the Supreme Court decided, you see things lining up very nicely. And by the way, I will note that I think the Supreme Court looked at the fact there's a settlement agreement, as you presumably did as well, and went, well, there's an agreement here. And so we have a contract rate, at least as to the people who signed it. And to us, now I'm getting to the alphabet hypothetical part of this case. To us, that's the right way to think about it. You can have a multilateral agreement, and all of the parties are bound to the public interest standard if they challenge it. Third parties that are downstream of those parties are also bound. We learned that in NRG. We have here prototypical third parties, by the way. If you had...
To go back to the letters for a minute.
I was going back there too.
Right. So A and B agree on a rate that binds C, who are these downstream parties. Okay, that's hypothetical. Your view is the Supreme Court decided that question or didn't?
C is downstream from A or B?
Well, that's the way you just put it, yes.
If you put it that way, yes. The Supreme Court did decide that question.
And said that Mobile Sierra applies to them as well.
That's correct.
So your view about this is different than both FERC and the petitioners. That is, both of them said that the only thing the Supreme Court decided, unless I've forgotten between the last argument and just now, was that the only thing the Supreme Court decided was that C can't challenge a contract between A and B, fixing the rates between A and B. Now, your position is that C also can't challenge a contract between A and B setting the rates for C.
No, Your Honor, we may be having a semantic crossroads here. Let's talk about who C is. Let's say C is the Attorney General of Connecticut, or IECG, complaining that Northeast Utilities is charging it too high a rate at retail because of these capacity payments, which we don't like. If Northeast Utilities and suppliers entered into a contract that imbued that triggered the public interest protection, then Northeast Utilities is bound by that standard. FERC is bound by that standard, and so are others who are indirectly affected. So we said in our Supreme Court brief that we all are affected by the contract between a movie theater and the popcorn supplier, but if you're a moviegoer, you don't get to litigate about it. So we have to look at who C is. If C is Northeast Utilities, and they are a purchaser, and they did not sign a contract, then Mobile Sierra does not apply, and if you're downstream of C, You also are freed of the public interest standard, as is FERC.
So then you agree with the other counsel here then on this point.
Your Honor,
let me put it a different way. Tell me in what respect you disagree.
I think there's been tremendous confusion about who C
that's,
is.
That's why I'm asking you to clarify.
And I'm not entirely sure, in particular, what the petitioners are saying on this point.
I wasn't either.
And if let's go to the settlement agreement itself for a second and talk about the alphabet soup here from that context, because I think it may add some clarity. There are many, many, many parties who supported the settlement. We say that creates contract rates. We also say the auctions create contract rates, but let's leave that aside for a second. We have challengers before you here at this stage of the proceeding who are all prototypical third parties under the language of NRG, consumers, elected officials acting parens patriae, and public service commissions. They are always going to be in a derivative position.
Right.
And they're, so we have to look at whose rate is being challenged. Our position is that all or practically all of the buyers and sellers in the market agreed under the settlement to the terms and to the public interest standard applying to the auction rates and the transition rates.
But not all of them. Not all of them on the same level.
You're referring to NSTAR?
Yes.
Okay, let's use that in terms of our hypotheticals, because I actually have an explanation that I think takes that away. As long as, even if you grant NSTAR is not a third party, then for the vast bulk of possible challenges, the public interest standard will apply. If someone is saying NSTAR is paying too much, charging too much to me, and they did not agree to be bound by the public interest standard, which is, in our judgment, Judge Silberman, the trigger more than whether there's a market forces sort of acting here. I think that can play a role, but it's really the agreement to be bound that's the key. If that's the case, then the Massachusetts Attorney General, perhaps, where NSTAR is located, could say, hey, I don't like this rate, and I'm subject to the ordinary just and reasonable standard. The reason that breaks down where the auction rates are concerned actually is that when it comes to the auction process and who actually pays the rates, all of the states here, including Massachusetts, have a process called retail choice or retail competition. So NSTAR auctions off the right to serve its customers at retail, and someone new comes to the fore inheriting, in fact, willingly competing for the right to be a buyer, have a capacity obligation and supply load. So you really have someone coming to the fore eventually who agrees to be bound. But even if I were wrong about all that, or you still have a situation where the vast preponderance of possible cases that could come would be protected by the public interest standard. So these are contract rates. That's our view. Now, I do agree that the Commission has discretion to analogize to a contract setting and apply a higher standard when they conclude Mobile Sierra does not necessarily apply. In this case, I would submit to you that this is not really an analogy. When they're talking in their decision, particularly on rehearing, about the need for certainty and the money that new entrants can sink into the ground based on this market, we think that reflects the fact that there actually are contractual obligations here. And if you look at the auction, we went through this in our brief, you have auctions are always contracts in any instance I can imagine, and you have a promise exchange for a promise. Each specific supplier, when you have the descending clock ticking its last downward tick, agrees, promises to supply a particular amount of a particular defined product capacity at a particular point in time and location and at a particular price, the auction clearing price, in return for a promise of payment. And as a result, you have many, many, many millions of dollars potentially being invested. That is, I say, analogous to a contract, but we submit it actually is a contract, and for this reason, too. The Commission was correct when they held, and I think they did in paragraph 90, that the auction rates and transition payments are contract rates. That's what IECG was arguing about. Well, the language is less than pellucid, I will grant you. We submit you can trace their reasoning. Now, it is...
That's a different
Is it fair to say that petitioner's argument was Mobile Sierra does not apply to this settlement?
No, Your Honor. I think that IECG made that argument as an alternative point.
No. I'm talking about petitioners.
I know. I think.
No. Petitioners said Mobile Sierra doesn't apply here.
Because we're non-signatory.
It said Mobile Sierra doesn't apply. Isn't that clear?
That's not how I read their rehearing.
Oh, I saw that. Now, to be sure, they did not specifically say Mobile Sierra doesn't apply because this is not a contract. But they said Mobile Sierra doesn't apply.
I still don't think that's enough, Your Honor. I think that if all you say is...
You're cutting the salami pretty thin. I think if the intervener hadn't made the argument so elegantly, you wouldn't have the contention you're making it.
Your Honor, I think it's akin to saying the commission didn't engage in reasoned decision-making without saying why.
No. That's specific. Mobile Sierra doesn't apply.
I would say that's not enough, but I think that if you look at their argument in its whole, they keep going back to the touchstone of we're not signatories. That's where their specification of error said. That colors everything, and it's why I would imagine you took that component of the case and decided it, because it was really the gravamen of their complaint, and why the commission, when they address the contract rate versus tariff rate question, only addresses themselves to IECG. So we would contend that the commission wasn't fairly apprised of this objection. It wasn't raised, and I go back to my point that if what you're arguing is, but we're not a signatory, we're third parties, you're necessarily conceding that you're bound, that you otherwise would be bound by a contract. And if you want to argue the obverse in the alternative, you need to say so directly. Otherwise, you're misleading the commission and not really giving them a chance to address things.
Do with the fact that FERC changed its position in the Supreme Court on whether these were contract rates?
Well, the orders, we think, still hold they are contract rates. And so if you don't dismiss...
You're relying on paragraph 90.
Yes.
You're reading,
read with paragraph 80.
Your reading is different than FERC's reading of its own order, correct?
And, well, it's not different than FERC's reading in its first brief. And they did change position in the Supreme Court coincident with a change in administrations. And... that did surprise us, but I think the order still speaks for itself, and the reasoning merits affirmance if you reach the merits, which we submit you shouldn't do. And that stands on the fact that a settlement agreement is a contract on its face. The Supreme Court was not simply issuing an advisory opinion without any basis. There is an agreement here. Now, you can debate whether it applies to everyone all the time, but there is an agreement, and there are contract rates, frankly, in the vast majority of circumstances, given how many people signed on to the settlement. And that point, I would submit to you, shouldn't get lost here. And that's really, I think, what the commission was addressing. Almost everybody signed this. We often apply Mobile Sierra to settlement agreements. And then they go on in the passage about rate stability to talk about contract stability and supply arrangements, quoting Mobile or Sierra. So I think they thought these were contracts, and you can trace that vein of reasoning. But in our view, the proper move is to dismiss.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
See, counsel for petitioners. Now, you wanted a chance at this point to respond to the jurisdictional argument. Is that correct?
I'd be happy to. We think, of course, that the court does have jurisdiction. As we put forward in our briefs, we've raised this issue before the FERC and the underlying decisions. Maine Public Utilities Commission specifically requested that or directed that this was not a, that this violated petitioner's Section 206 rights. IECG directly raised the issue, as Judge Silverman, you said, put it very eloquently. But I'd also like to take a look at the third-party argument that we've made throughout this proceeding that really is the flip side of what it is. A third party is determined by what kind of rate is applying to that party. As you pointed out, and Judge, you said that you were a little confused by our position on what A and B, if they entered into a contract, whether C could challenge that.
Well, wait a minute. Before you do that, on the jurisdictional point, you did specifically contest the proposition that Mobile Sierra applied.
We certainly did, yes.
That's
we did.
That was the basic argument.
And also, I would put it even more specifically than that, that because it we also argued that it doesn't apply to third parties, the Supreme Court carved out a niche of what kind of third party it does apply to. That is, it applies to a third party who might be downstream. If there is a Mobile Sierra contract rate, which we dispute exists here, if there is a Mobile Sierra contract rate, a downstream user is not permitted to challenge that rate as among the two parties that agreed to it. However,
that is, incidentally, that is the way I understood it. I got really confused at the ABCD hypothetical. But I
want to go back to the jurisdictional point for a moment, if we could.
Excuse me.
How do you respond that the statement you made to FERC in your petition for rehearing assumes there is a contract? To make the argument you want to make now, you have to argue there is not a contract rate involved. It's a tariff rate. Intervenor argues those are two separate arguments and they contradict each other.
Yes. What certainly the intervenor IECG specifically raised the issue that this is a tariff. I will say the language that we may have used was not as precise as it might have been. But
so if ECG.
Industrial Energy Consumers.
Had not filed a petition for rehearing, would your position be the same?
Yes, it would. And the reason is, I believe, that the third party, when we say it applies to a third party, there are two separate kinds of third parties. One third party that is challenging a contract rate, and one third party that is challenging the imposition of a settlement term upon that party directly. That there's no Mobile Sierra relation between the party that is challenging a settlement term as it is applied to them directly, and that's different from a third party that the Supreme Court has issued
and
a ruling.
So your very general statement was sufficient to alert the agency to that distinction.
Yes, and obviously the point of raising these questions on rehearing is to put the agency on notice that this is an issue and allow them to correct it. And the IECG certainly put the agency on notice, and the FERC disavowed that and specifically ruled against the IECG. But I do believe that the two questions are flip sides of the same coin. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, we think because all of these rates emanate from a contested settlement, that for the reasons we articulated before, no Mobile Sierra presumption can arise from any of the rates. That is, once FERC is obligated to review these rates under an ordinary, just, and reasonable basis, that no Mobile Sierra presumption may subsequently arise, and that those rates are not contract rates.
What I'm trying to understand is if we hold that there's jurisdiction here, we have to reconcile it with our precedent that talks about under this particular statute, objections have to be specific.
Yes, and I believe in the statute it does provide that if there's and we mentioned this in our brief, if there's a lack of the precise clarity that we would have otherwise done, we think that's there's reasonable cause for that to have happened by the intervention of the Supreme Court's two decisions in Morgan Stanley and NRG that have changed the language about which we are speaking about these.
In other words, I want to be clear on that because obviously the intervener raised the argument before FERC. So, I mean, you were aware of it in that sense at the rehearing stage. So the argument here is that your whole focus is, as Judge Silberman has elaborated, that Mobile Sierra just doesn't apply to you as a third party.
Correct. And it still does not apply to us as a third party.
And so long as FERC was insisting that it was a contract rate, that was all you needed to say to FERC.
That's absolutely correct. If we're relying upon what FERC's articulated grounds are, and if FERC had articulated a different ground of the circuit court, we might not have taken the extra trip to the Supreme Court as well, because all the parties would have had the opportunity to address that fully at the circuit court.
So you think we can't read FERC's opinion to make the same argument that FERC is making now about the grounds for upholding the decision?
I understand that this goes to the issue of whether it should properly be remanded.
Yeah, this wasn't a trick question. We've been discussing this for a while.
We don't think it should be remanded, and the reason is, as the Supreme Court held, and I understand your position on the Tenery case, it would be an idle formality to send it back down to the FERC to rearticulate the grounds that they fully articulated at the Supreme Court, and they fully articulated here.
But if you thought they fully articulated them in the for the agency, then you should have fully articulated your objection. So your position has to be that they didn't before the agency fully articulated.
At the agency decision and the underlying the order on rehearing, the FERC specifically denied the issue that these were contract rates, the tariff rates, not subject to the mobile CR presumption.
So this argument about not remanding is that somehow you think the agency is bound to adopt the position of the lawyers who are arguing here and in the Supreme Court.
I would go you one step further than that. I believe that FERC is prohibited from adopting any mobile Sierra doctrine. There is absolutely no discretion. The mobile Sierra doctrine itself is grounded only in contracts. And because it's grounded only in contracts, you can make the next necessary logical.
Now you're suggesting the Supreme Court's remand was inappropriate.
No, I think the Supreme Court quite wisely considered that these were most appropriately fleshed out at the circuit court levels where the judges have the most experience with dealing with FERC.
Wait a minute. You're saying there was nothing we're entitled to say, that it's simply mobile Sierra as a matter of law doesn't apply?
No, I think they just deferred issuing the ruling.
That is your position. Mobile Sierra as a matter of law doesn't apply.
Correct. Correct.
The agency's position now is that they have discretion, correct?
That is the agency's position.
And I take it your position would be we can't uphold on that ground because that wasn't their position before the agency, correct?
You cannot uphold on that ground. At the same token, we believe you can issue
because it wasn't the position of the agency at the time.
That is one ground.
Well, and that's the definition of Chenery. So why are you resisting?
I'm resisting because I think, for the same reasons articulated by the FERC, that is the most appropriate and expeditious resolution. The one area where we do agree with all the parties is that it is a good thing to have some kind of stability going forward.
Each of you assume you're going to win. You know, this, I assume neither of you are against remand if the alternative is losing. Well, let me put it to you. Are you so interested in our views that you wouldn't mind losing rather than remanding?
I'm confident that the court is capable of sorting through that.
Is your position that even if you were going to lose, you prefer that over a remand? It's not, right? So certainty isn't really what you want. You want certainty of your position.
No, I think certainty is an independent value, and that's good. Of course, we think we're right. We wouldn't be standing here making these arguments if we...
Wouldn't you go to the Supreme Court?
There's a possibility.
Notwithstanding the lack of certainty. Okay, fine. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. We will take the case under advisement.